Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Well, today we have got a topic that I've never even heard this man's name, Velikovsky. And when I received the book on the Velikovsky heresies, it piqued my interest because it was about a man that lived so long ago. And with me today is Laird Scranton. Now, Laird is, in a way, sort of an odd duck. He is a software designer, yet as much as he's oriented into the world of technology, he has also had a fascination with history, with myths, with language, with cosmology, and he's written other books. But this one really intrigued me. I want to welcome to the airwaves Laird Scranton. Welcome to the show, Laird.
Thank you very much, Donna. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I hope you don't mind me calling you an odd duck.
Oh, not a bit. That's probably one of the nicest things I've been called.
Well, I called you that not to be insulting, but to say that you're a man that really mentally likes to explore various paradigms of thinking, and you're not afraid to go backwards, forwards, sideways, upside down, right side up. It doesn't make any difference. You're saying, what if? And that is what Velikovsky did also. This is such an interesting man. Tell us how you became acquainted with him and why it was that he piqued your interest so much that you did research on him.
Okay, well, Velikovsky, Emmanuel Velikovsky was, he wrote in the 1950s, and he was a friend and a colleague of Albert Einstein's. They worked together on a number of projects over the years, and they ended up teaching together at Princeton. I learned about Velikovsky first when I was in high school in Portland, Oregon, and there were a couple of student papers back in the 1950s in Portland that were active supporters of Velikovsky's and fostered debate about his theories. Velikovsky is considered to be the heretic's heretic. He came out with a book called Worlds in Collision in 1950 that was based on ancient mythology and ancient texts, and he compared what different cultures had to say about certain events that happened in the past and concluded that from these texts that Venus had to be a fairly recent addition to the family of planets. The name Venus in the Greek language means the newcomer. And all these cultures discussed Venus initially as if it were a comet. They described it as having a comet's tail, and its behavior was like a comet. And they claimed that Venus had sort of wreaked havoc through the solar system back in about 1500 B.C., had made a close approach to the Earth and caused effects that Velikovsky associated with the time of the Exodus from Egypt when the 10 plagues happened. And said that Venus eventually settled down to become a planet like all the other planets. Originally, it was so bright in the sky, you could see it during the daytime, and they classed it with the sun and the moon instead of the planets because they thought it was more like the sun and the moon. So Velikovsky wrote this very controversial book that upset astronomers terribly in 1950 and was declared flat nonsense by any number of leading authorities at the time it was written. Even Einstein didn't have a lot of support for Velikovsky's book in the beginning until around 1952, when certain things Velikovsky said must be true about science started to be proving themselves true, even though they went against the conventional wisdom at the time. And one of the points that Einstein had made against Velikovsky was proved false in 1952, and Einstein ended up reversing himself and offering to support Velikovsky's efforts, and then died shortly after that so that he wasn't able to really do very much for Velikovsky. But the leading astronomers of the world conducted sort of a witch hunt against Velikovsky that some people compare to what happened to Galileo, you know, when he was persecuted by the Catholic Church. And eventually Velikovsky became a persona non grata whose name is practically never mentioned unless someone finds a fact that goes against him, and then they trumpet it very loudly. But over the 60 years since Velikovsky wrote, hardly a week goes by that there isn't some kind of a scientific finding that really is in support of what Velikovsky had to say. And so I thought, given all the new scientific probes that have been sent to Venus and to Mars and to Jupiter and to study comets over the past few years, that this would be a good time to try to update the controversy a little bit with the new science.
Boy, I'm glad you did. And I'm so glad that the book came into my hands. One of the statements that you make in the book that I really like is that his publication, Worlds in Collision, in 1950, its thesis dared, as I'm quoting from your book, dared to cross the invisible boundaries that are traditionally observed between a number of different academic disciplines. I am utterly fascinated with history. And whether I'm reading or studying something about history that goes back to the cavemen, the aboriginals, something in the 1500s, or even in recent history, let's say in the 20th century, I find that there's a consistency in that the established institutions, I don't care whether they're religiously affiliated, whether they are businesses, whatever it is, I'll use the word institution to encapsulate all of them. They get into their paradigms and they do everything to keep those paradigms in place. Murders have been committed to keep paradigms in place. Eventually they collapse. And Velikovsky, I think, was an extremely brave man to be able to speak out the way he did. And when we look at the technology that he had to work with at the time, and you brought up what we are working with today, this man was a visionary.
Well, yes, and a lot of what Velikovsky had to say, once you have the basic scenario, his scenario is that Venus was, like the myths say, born from the head of... It was ejected from Jupiter and initially behaved like a comet and moved around the solar system, and it impacted Mars, according to Velikovsky, and it made a close approach to the Earth and... took a couple of thousand years to settle down into the orbit that it's currently in. But these things that Velikovsky has, the scenario that he paints, has certain logical conclusions that you can draw based on the situation. And so a lot of the things Velikovsky, the predictions he made that turned out to be correct scientifically, are just the logical consequence of the scenario he painted. So, yes, he was very insightful, but a lot of it didn't depend on having to, have premonitions about this stuff. If you think about the fact that Venus is a young planet, then it probably is going to be very hot. It's a logical conclusion, and it's probably going to have a pristine surface. And if it's been roaming around the solar system doing things it shouldn't have been doing, it probably doesn't have the same kind of a rotation and an orbit as the rest of the planets have. And so Velikovsky was able to make these kinds of prognostications based on the scenario.
In his research, you state that he theorized that the pattern of the physical disruption that legends that go back thousands of years talk about, the ancient texts, he said, makes sense if we would take into account that there was something that entered our space that shifted our planet, and it's called tipping of the planet. And in so many legends, he found that there were the descriptions, the stars fell, the sunrise was in a different place. And he was so methodical about how he looked at this, and his logic, if you're just to stand back and observe it, it really isn't far-fetched at all, knowing what we know today. And
that's
that there's been other discussions where if there were certain planets that came in, there very easily could be a shift of the Earth itself. And this isn't new. This is something that's happened to this planet many times. And when you have those gravitational pulls or whatever orbits might be interfered with, it's phenomenal stuff. And we have no control over that.
No, and a lot of this is actually more demonstrable than you would think it would be. For instance, Velikovsky says that around 750 BC, Mars made a close approach to the Earth that actually moved our planet. It changed the movements of our planet, and it extended our year from 360 days to 365 days. Now, that kind of a statement is actually a testable statement, because if it really happened, then the computer programs that we have that calculate retrospectively the dates of things like eclipses, you know, they depend on the motions of the Earth being a constant, like a constant cosmic clock, a celestial clock.
Mm-hmm.
So if that rotation had been disrupted, then the disruption should create a boundary that we can't calculate past. And so we should find eclipses reported as happening on certain dates and certain locations that the computer program can't confirm. And, in fact, that's what we do find. And one of my points is that it's hard to think of anything that could cause that except a disruption of the planet. So that's a testable statement. And at each stage of Velikovsky's scenario, you have these considerations, maybe a half dozen considerations at each stage of the scenario, that if Velikovsky's right, all the considerations are explained. But if he's wrong, you've got this handful of coincidences that make it look like he's right. And that really shouldn't happen with a theory that's flatly wrong. That typically happens with a theory that's right. And so when I began to notice that we had that situation again and again and again with him, that says to me, this is the hallmark of a theory that really can't be wrong.
A point that he brings up, I know I've had a number of discussions with people over the past few years, and my husband and I have often discussed something that we don't hear many people bringing up, and that is volcanic activity. There is so much volcanic activity that has been going on since the 1980, Mount St. Helens. I'm here in the Pacific Northwest. Mount St. Helens blew, and it was just a phenomenal experience. We watched it from our front porch. Well, we've had, in the past 3 years, we've had volcanoes, big things happening in Hawaii, we've had stuff happening in South America, we've had stuff happening, you know, in Iceland, we've had it happen in Alaska, and for some reason, people just seem to glaze over it, and one of the aspects of history that Velikovsky went into was a phenomenally large eruption, a volcano named Thera. Now, when did this happen, and how did he come across the information regarding this volcanic happening? Because the time frame of this would fit in with many of the different ancient stories that have been perpetuated through centuries.
That's right. Well, in trying to give a date for these things, one of the difficulties is that back in Velikovsky's day, they had a different sense of the timing of things, and the timing has since been revised. So an event that Velikovsky says happened in 1500 BC, they now are pinning closer to 1600 BC. But they still align with physical events like the eruption of Thera, and they align with the end of the Minoan Empire and the end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt. So that's the period of time we're talking about for when Velikovsky says that Venus came close to the Earth. This is the time of the Exodus from Egypt. And Velikovsky got put onto this idea because he found an Egyptian text that seemed to be reporting calamities that sounded like the 10 plagues in Egypt. And so that made him think that maybe there was some historic basis for the claims. And he realized that a lot of the effects that were reported, like seeing a pillar of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night, that's a classic description of the pillar of smoke that comes out of a volcano. He realized that if the volcano was spewing iron-rich material, that it could turn a river red, and that it could poison a river, that river, and cause all the vermin in the river to flee. So a lot of the different effects that are cited as plagues in Egypt are could be the direct result of this eruption. One of the things I include in my book is a map of the likely fallout area from that eruption, and you can see that it passes directly over Egypt. The claim that people had sores erupting on their skin at that time, well, that's something that happened to people who were downwind from Mount St. Helens when it erupted. There are other effects like that. Now, some of the effects that happened are reasonably, that we could show happened about that period of time, are reasonably attributed to the close approach of an astronomic body. For instance, there's a major fluctuation they can't explain in the magnetic field of the Earth about that time that makes sense if you say that another magnetized body came nearby. There are changes in the acidity levels of the ice cores that they study that show that that period of time was one of the most volcanically eruptive eras in all of geologic history, dating back 4 billion years. So,
wow.
There's scientific evidence to support the idea that something really big happened about that period of time. And if you postulate that it's what Velikovsky says, then numbers of different mysteries just evaporate. They're explained right away. And if you don't, if you postulate that he's wrong, then you're left, again, holding this basket of coincidences that make it look like he's right. And how do you explain that? So that's sort of the viewpoint that I approach this from. My goal in writing the book was to try to turn up a fact that would finally, after 60 years, show that Velikovsky either absolutely had to be right or absolutely had to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really where I got to. I did get to quite a bit of new evidence that had never been cited about Velikovsky that certainly makes it look like he was right.
Well, he's a fascinating man, and one of his statements that he made was he had 9 specific claims. One, and this included his belief that there'd be remnant magnetism found on the moon, that the surface of the moon would exhibit a steep thermal gradient, and that radioactive hot spots would be found, and the moon would be shown to suffer from frequent moonquakes. And we've had lunar landings, there's been tremendous research. Everything he said about the moon proved to be true.
It's true, and one claim that he made about the moon, he had one of his closest friends and supporters told him flatly he was going to be wrong about, because he was claiming they were going to find water just under the surface of the moon. And last year, they sure enough turned up water just underneath the surface of the moon.
Isn't that fascinating? Here is a man who back in the 50s was making these statements. He was like a Jules Verne of his time, although he didn't write books in the sense of writing fables to be able to perpetuate what his perceptions were. He put them in black and white. He didn't have to cloak them in anything unique. But I loved what he said in 1972. When the Society of Harvard Engineers and Scientists invited Velikovsky to speak to their student body. And the students were thrilled that he was there, and his comment was, and I quote, "I survived, you see. I have been waiting for this evening for 22 years. I came here to find the young, the spirited, the men who have a fascination for discovery." How inspiring that had to have been for all of those men that attended this tremendous meeting, inviting a man who was considered to be the black sheep among all of the scientists. I mean, this guy really was blacklisted by the scientific community, big time.
Of science. He's a man whose name is not typically mentioned. Unless they can make an announcement that they flatly believe goes against him, they don't mention his name.
Mm-hmm.
And if they come up with a finding that could support him, they do everything they can at the time they announce it to distance it from him. For instance, they found a molecule on Venus recently that is the a very common molecule found in the atmosphere of comets. And when they announced the discovery, it's the first time it's been found on a planet, they had to include the comment that this molecule is thought to be produced on a planet in a very different way than it's produced in a comet. They actually understated. They didn't even say. They said that this molecule is sometimes found around comets, when the truth of the matter is that it's the most common radical found in the atmosphere of a comet. So they were just understating and distancing as much as they could the announcement from Velikovsky. Velikovsky said that one of the key proofs of his theory would be if we got to Venus and found out that it was both hot and had a pristine surface. Well, when they got to Venus, they did discover that it was hot enough, the surface was hot enough to melt lead, and they also discovered that it had far fewer craters than it should have if it was billions of years old. So each of those announcements were made hand-in-hand with a brand-new theory to explain away the fact without having to say that Venus was could possibly be a young planet.
It's absolutely fascinating to me.
Unknown geological forces that have somehow resurfaced the whole planet.
You go back into ancient Hindu astronomic writings that spoke of Venus as a planet. You have so many different points, and one of them was, could Venus have been ejected from Jupiter? Now, just that thought gives a visual that makes you wonder, wow, is this a possibility? There are so many assumptions made about planets, how they came about, when honestly we don't know.
Right, my friend.
And
Jeff
I find
Marcy,
it interesting that scientists frequently will come up with anything instead of saying, you know, I really don't know the answer to that. Why is that so hard?
You're right. Last month, my friend Jeff Marcy, who is a Berkeley astronomer who's been leading the search for some of these Earth-like planets and other solar systems, wrote an article and said that the information that he's gained by doing these studies tells him that our theories of planet formation have to be flatly wrong. They flatly contradict the theories we've got, which means that Velikovsky's belief that Venus was ejected from Jupiter makes as much sense as anything that's on the table right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he says that, you also have to consider that it's already a part of the traditional theory, astronomic theory, that our own moon was created by that same kind of a process, that something whacked into the Earth and knocked off the moon. So to say that it could happen on a small scale and not happen on a larger scale doesn't seem like it's very sensible to me.
You make a statement about, well, in your book, let me read it verbatim, because it has to do with the Earth's magnetic tail. And this is what's said. It's an extension of the same familiar magnetic field we experience when using a Boy Scout compass to find out our way around the Earth's surface. Our entire planet is enveloped in a bubble of magnetism, which springs from a molten dynamo in the Earth's core. Out in space, the solar wind presses against this bubble and stretches it, creating a long magnet tail in the downwind direction. And anyone can tell when the moon is inside this magnetotail. And if you see, if the moon's full, it's inside the magnetotail. And if it enters the magnetotail 3 days before it's full, it takes about 6 days to cross and exit on the other side. Wow. I mean, I don't remember being taught anything like that when I was in school. That is really exciting stuff. A magnetic tail. Do they teach that in astronomy classes today in school?
I don't know if they do today. They certainly didn't when I was in school, but, you know, things do change. It turns out that Venus actually has a tail, too, that is more like a comet's tail. It's called an ion tail, and the European Space Agency sent a probe called Venus Express that's been in orbit around Venus for a couple of years now. And every time it went around, it would try to count the number of ions in the atmosphere, and it was discovering that it was losing ions, and it couldn't figure out where they were going. And they finally figured out that some of the ions were being transferred from the daytime side of Venus to the nighttime side, same way that the tail of a comet points away from the sun. And then they discover that some of these ions are actually being blown completely off the planet out into space. And then with a little more study, they discovered that when Venus comes close to the Earth, this ion tail extends as far as the Earth, which is millions of miles, and points directly at the Earth, which is one of the suggestions that there might have been some kind of a close contact between the two planets. At the same point, Venus always turns its same face to the Earth, which is another indicator that there could have been close contact between the two bodies. So Venus actually has a tail that's produced by the same process as a comet's tail that's invisible right now. But it makes sense to me that if ancient cultures all reported a tail on Venus, and we get there and we find out it actually has one, that 3,000 years ago, this tail must have been visible. It doesn't make sense that the ancients reported it but couldn't see it. So meanwhile, the astronomers have discovered a planet in one of these exosolar systems that actually has a tail. So we know it's possible for a planet to have one.
Fascinating. Something that is brought out, too, and this was a study by Gilda Bartoloni and Filippo Delfino, and that is on radiocarbon dating. And this is far from being an exact science. In fact, according to the material that you present in the book, a lot of the radiocarbon dating is faulty because we don't have exact capabilities of assessing information the way so many people assume that we can. And the theories are made up off of what they assume are correct. And I loved what you said in the book. It's radiocarbon dating is affected by a change in the amounts of isotopes, taken in by plants and animals during the crucial early centuries of the first millennium B.C., and thus dates given in older literature are no longer reliable. Not only that, soil conditions in most Italian sites have not preserved the wood samples needed to calibrate dates by tree ring comparisons, as has been possible for Transalpine Europe. There's so many other points of information. And in a way, it's exciting, because I'd like to think that maybe the younger generation will go, whoa, let's see what we can find out. This may be partially true, but not totally true. And
that's
I think
true.
That's something that your book about the Velikovsky heresies, as they were perceived by science in the 1950s, my goodness, can you imagine how they would have received him in the 1600s?
yes.
It would have been a real winner. They probably would have burned him at the stake. And
this whole question of carbon dating and rocks is the problem, because when you're carbon dating something, you can carbon date something that's organic, but it's a different question when you're trying to carbon date rocks. And I wondered how it was that they kept returning dates that were billions of years old for the moon rocks. How could that be if Velikovsky was right? Well, it turns out that there are two different sets of techniques they use for carbon dating rocks. One they only use on rocks they think are very young, and the other they use only on rocks that they think are very old. So they first skew the results to begin with by deliberately choosing the technique they know is going to return an old date. But when you carbon date a rock, you have to make an assumption about how much isotope was in the rock to begin with, and we don't know for sure how much there was in the moon rocks. So when they make that estimate, they're affecting the outcome of the test. And so all these carbon dating tests, all the carbon dating tests they've done, or the radiometric tests they've done on these rocks, are producing a result that's based on an assumption that's going to give them that result.
Fascinating stuff. I know we're almost finished here. I want to mention to those of you that are listening, you can go to innertraditions.com and find out about this book, The Velikovsky Heresies. And again, Laird Scranton is my guest. But I want to close out our interview, Laird. You say, an article that you have read recently points out that most paradigm-changing discoveries in science in the recent decades have been made by outsiders to the field. And perhaps this is because an outsider may feel less constrained to limit his or her thinking to the set of instructed possibilities that fall within the boundaries of accepted theory. Perhaps, too, an outsider may be less cognizant of where the boundaries of accepted theory actually fall and so may unwittingly fail to observe them. And these are my words, and they go beyond what anybody had ever expected could be achieved. I think that this is just a fascinating book. Laird Scranton, I'm just so pleased that you were able to put it together. It introduced me to a man that I think has left a legacy that should inspire students of science in the most fascinating way. And for those of you listening, Velikovsky is spelled V-E-L-I-K-O-V-S-K-Y. Laird Scranton, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you very much, Donna. I really appreciate it.
This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. Check out innertraditions.com and the Velikovsky Heresies. Yes, good reading. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me. Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. I'm so delighted you were able to join me today. If you would like to let me assist you with some challenges of questions in your life, then give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And if you're a first-time listener, what you do is just give me a buzz, give me your first name or initial. I always like to know where you're calling in from. And then I will tell you what I perceive about you as an individual, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that is of concern to you. Again, 888-627-6008. With the interview with Laird Scranton today, I thought I would share with you a quote from Napoleon Hill, who I just have always had such a tremendous admiration for. This man took 20 years out of his life to do research. He was challenged by one of the wealthiest men in the United States to do the research. He did it, and it changed his life forever. The book I have in hand in front of me is called The Law of Success. Now, this was his original manuscript. And if ever you have a chance to get this book and add it to your library, I recommend it highly because it is just chock-packed with wisdom. His very famous book, Think and Grow Rich, was extrapolated from this massive volume of information. And the wisdom holds true just as much today as it did at the time that he wrote it. But relative to what we were discussing earlier, to break through established paradigms, and if you study history, you'll find that every single generation has it, and it takes guts to move past it. It takes a searching mind. It takes a willing to question. It takes a willingness to be able to say, I wonder, and examine not just one side, but multiple sides of something. It requires thinking. Napoleon Hill made a statement. True education means mind development, not merely the gathering and classifying of knowledge. Now think about those words. True education means mind development, not merely the gathering and classifying of knowledge. Now, that mind development comes about through experience. And how we view our experience colors our perception, or clouds our perception, or illuminates our perception. It depends on how we are willing to look at various facets. And I just think that that's what learning is all about. Nobody ever has it all. Nobody ever knows it all. They may say they do, and if they do, then I would say move on, because there's no such human being on the face of this planet or any other planet. It takes so many parts to make knowledge usable. It really does. When you study history and you look at various components of history, I was just watching something that was portraying the medieval ages. And they did a very good portrayal. It wasn't sanitary. It was muddy. People died very, very young. And food was hard to come by. Wars were going on all the time. Barbaric patternings of attitude about people. And it was just really, it was a pretty ugly period. Dark ages. Yep, that's what they were. Very, very dark ages. And, you know, the only way to avoid those dark ages is by a willingness to grow and expand and to learn and to investigate, look at different paradigms, and just like Velikovsky, go beyond where everybody has established these little safety markers and say, what else is there? I think that's the reason Star Trek was so popular. I think that Gene Roddenberry was a man that had extraordinary vision, and I don't know if you know this or not, but a lot of the people that worked with him on scripts were scientists. Scientists that in the everyday norm wouldn't have even been given an opportunity to expand their imaginative capacities. I know because I interviewed a young man that had been trained under some of the top scientists in the world. And he was able to be a part of that group that put script material together. And you know what I think is absolutely awesome? Is how the person in the theater that people thought didn't have the brains of a turnip, they went, yes, this is possible. Yes, this is what we can do. And the Gene Roddenberrys of the world pushes forward. Jules Verne did it. H.G. Wells did it. And there were others. It's fascinating. And we have some fabulous people today that are doing the same thing. But what is bothering me is that there is a very negative side that I'm hearing. And all of this doomsday and this destruction. Well, I know this part of the human personality that really loves the dark side. I'm not one of them. I believe that we can do so many things that are going to surpass even what people that had, let's say, the vision could have even imagined. And it takes education. We need to encourage our young people to get excited about learning, to not be afraid of life, to embrace the opportunity to explore. There's so much that we need to learn. I think it's marvelous. And that's why encouraging kids to read is so important, to be able to investigate, putting them into environments where they can learn how to brainstorm. I love the competition that's done at MIT. It's done every year. And students, and it started out with a professor that found that his students were just not learning. They were memorizing. And this MIT is known for engineering and for all kind of innovative thinking. And these students, this professor found, they could quote everything. They memorized the books. And he thought, this isn't going to work very well. They're not going to handle the real world. So he started off with giving every student a batch of junk. That's right, a batch of junk. Screws, bolts, strings, wires, whatever. And he said, okay, now you're to build something out of it. And he said, you're going to find that so many of the rules of engineering that you've learned in the books do not apply. And not only that, but he made them work in teams. And he said, the reason you have to learn how to work in a team is so that you understand that nobody knows it all. You have to learn how to think and do your brainstorming and come up with solutions. Well, I'll tell you, what these young minds do, it's amazing, absolutely amazing, with a pile of junk. A pile of junk. They are a very good example of what can be accomplished. And there's failures and there's all kinds of things that go on. But they are saying yes to the opportunity to make junk do what was supposedly not possible. And I think that's a marvelous challenge. And we need to look at life that way. We need to be able to look at life with that sense of enthusiasm, with realizing that maybe for the moment life might be handing us a batch of junk. So what do we do with it? What are we going to create out of it? How are we going to redesign our lives? What are we going to do with what we've got? And no whining and no complaining. What are we going to do with what we've got? Who can we integrate with? Who can we brainstorm with to get out of our box? And so often we're in a box of fear. How do we get out of that? Ah, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. All I need is your first name or initial, and then after that, relax, and I'll tell you what I perceive. Cherry blossoms. Oh, my goodness, here in the Pacific Northwest, it is so absolutely gorgeous. It's crisply cool outside, perfect for just going out and looking at spring with her magnificence just beginning to show. The cherry blossom trees are coming into flower, and Sulan Taylor has a most magnificent photograph going along with a poem. And this is how it reads. Cherry blossoms in all their beauty fill the countryside with a scent of spring. Oh, it's wonderful. It's invigorating. Of course, those of us in the Pacific Northwest get a little bit of giddiness when the sun comes out. It's like the moss in the brain starts drying out. We just don't know what to do with ourselves. And by the way, I want to remind you that there's this huge, huge National Cherry Blossom Festival. It's running from March 20th to April 27th in Washington, D.C. And if ever, and there's other parts of the country that are doing the same. They're in Macon, Georgia, Brooklyn, New York, Pasadena, California. You can go and find out where there are areas where the National Cherry Blossom Festivals are occurring. They've just grown these beautiful, beautiful trees. So you can go to the nationalcherryblossomfestival.org and /about/links to get all of the details. They're spectacular. They're absolutely wonderful. Well, I wanted to share with you a couple of stories. I know we're going to be going on break, but I wanted to mention a tip or two. These are just practical tips that if you have silver things, which I do, I'm not talking about jewelry here, but let's say you've got silverware and you have got teapots and maybe you have pretty little plates and you want to work with them, you can take cream toothpaste. Now, you've got to make sure it has no whitening agents in it or fluoride, just a simple cream toothpaste, and it polishes silver beautifully. Have you ever tried that? I would never have even thought of that in a million years. It works absolutely marvelously. So you can take care of your silver. You don't have to spend a whole bunch of money on polish. You rub it gently on the silver item, rinse it, and then dry and buff it with a clean, soft cloth. Now, they say you can use it on silver jewelry. I haven't tried that yet. And you don't have any damaging chemicals. Just a little tip if you have anything like that around. This is Donna Siebel. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Siebel to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. Quick like a bunny, I want to give you some information. Tomorrow, I'm going to be appearing at the Emerald Spiral event. This is a psychic expo in Kent, Washington, at the Kent Commons location. The hours for this wonderful event are 9 until 5. Food will be there, all kinds of exhibitors. This is one of the oldest events of its kind in the state of Washington. And I'm going to be there doing many sessions for people, and I'm going to have an abundance of books. So if you want to find out more information, including driving directions, check out emeraldspiral.com. My second announcement is about my Quantum Mind 3 class, which is occurring on April the 14th. On April the 14th, Robert Newman and I will be presenting this wonderful full-day event from 10 until 4. And it's going to be in University Place, Washington. And he is going to be teaching about Chinese medicine in the first part of the class. I'm going to be talking about dreams. We're going to be doing mind development skills in the second part of the class. And, of course, this is very interactive, and you'll have plenty of opportunity to ask questions. It is just really a fabulous class, and I hope that you will want to be included. So all you need to do is contact me at my office to make a reservation, 253-582-5604, Saturday, April the 14th, and we will be taking your reservation. The fee for the class is $59.95, and that does include lunch, and if you pay for it at the door, it's $69.95. So do give me a call, 253-582-5604. I wanted to share a story with you that is a little bit of what you call the paranormal. It's not something that is easily explainable. And we're going to go back to the late 1800s, and then move up into the 1920s. These are documented events. Now, in Pondicherry, India, in 1985, the month of June, there was a mist that materialized inside a closed room. There was an individual that was sitting inside this room. The person's name was Andre. And this mist created an explosion. And it was a rather severe one. In 1931, off the coast of White Bay, Newfoundland, there was a film producer and an associate. It was Verrick Frissell and Arthur Penrod. They were aboard a wooden whaling ship. The ship's name was Viking. They were wanting to find conditions, situations that would enable them to append to a movie they were making on a seal hunt. Now, they thought they needed more sensational footage. Well, this ship was carrying quite a bit of dynamite and a lot of powder kegs. Now, Frissell and Penrod wanted to use these so that they could blow up a few gigantic icebergs. This was their inspiration. The vessel, the Viking, ended up becoming locked inside of ice. Now, one of the men on the ship became very, very concerned about the massive amount of explosives they had and was on his way to talk to Frissell because he wanted to say, this is dangerous, our being landlocked in the ice, so to speak. And Frissell was actually in the process of writing out a warning, and the ship exploded. The stern was blown off of the boat. Those that survived had to walk over ice to get to the Horse Islands. In 1921, there was a residence of the Frost family, and it was on Ferrystone Road in London. Now, coal was a method of heating homes at that time, and a good amount of it had been purchased. And as it was in the house, the coal began to explode. The people were very concerned. The police were called. A police inspector came in. They stated to the police that the coal exploded while it was sitting cold in their coal buckets. Not only that, but the coal that had been put into fire grates that had not been set on fire was jumping out of the fire grates and passing through the walls from one room to the next. The walls were not damaged when this happened. The inspector picked up one of the pieces of coal, was holding it, and it vanished right in front of his eyes. I wonder what that was all about. Who knows? People are still scratching their heads over this. There's so much in life that we honestly cannot explain. Well, I do want to share with you some information about our upcoming guest next week. We're going to be talking about The Ordinary Sacred by Kent Nerburn, and then a subject that piques everyone's interest when they hear the word Atlantis. Ah, yes, Atlantis Beneath the Ice. Rand Femat is going to be my guest on Tuesday. Then we're going to be talking about the body ecology. Donna Gates is a researcher, and this is relating to health and what has been learned. And then also we're going to be talking about free fall with Sally Anderson. And then we're going to be discussing clutter a week from today. Oh, boy, don't we all have to deal with that. Sally Fenton is going to be my guest. So we have got just a lot of good, interesting people that we're going to be having on the air, and I hope that you will be able to join us. Well, I wanted to share a story about a woman that, because of writing notes of appreciation to people, has created something just absolutely phenomenal. But we're just about out of time, so that's not going to happen. And then I also had a marvelous, marvelous recipe that I wanted to share with you, but we're just going to have to wait until next week to be able to get to that. And again, I want to remind those of you listening, don't forget I'm going to be at the Emerald Spiral tomorrow, my class on April the 14th. Oh, and I almost forgot to announce one of the most important things that's coming up. The Donna Sebo Show is going to be moving to 9 a.m. Pacific time as of May the 1st. That's right. After 6 years of being on from 3 to 4 in the afternoon Pacific time, now it's going to shift to 9 a.m. from 9 until 10 a.m. on May 1st Pacific time. So we're going to have more information. I'll be sending out information in my emails. Also, it'll be up on my website, and I know it's going to be stated on BBS as well. In fact, I think it's already posted there. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever let anybody put limitations on you, and don't put them on yourself. Life is a marvelous adventure that has all kinds of wonderful experiences for you to be able to reach out for. Don't be afraid. Life is to be lived, not just existed through. Take care. Have a fabulous weekend. I'll talk with you right here on Monday, same time, same place, here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.